News.
New York City.
FAQ NYC podcast getting more and more interesting by the minute.
FAQ.
It's FAQ NYC, the New Yorkers podcast from the newsroom by and for New Yorkers, the city. I'm Dr. Christina Greer here with Katie Honan and Harry Siegel. Hello, gang.
Hi.
Hey.
They're going to run down some of the news from a truly jam-packed week in New York City. Let's jump right in.
Hey. So, on the tech front, Eric Adams approved a plan for self-driving cars to start testing operations in New York. And separately, he announced a plan to start using mobile weapons detectors in the train system, promising a pilot within 90 days. We'll dig into all that a little later when Albert Foxconn of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, STOP, joins us. More immediately, the city was mourning this week, and the mayor spoke movingly on Saturday at the funeral of slain NYPD officer Jonathan Diller, who was shot as he approached a car. Two guys, long criminal records inside. He was posthumously promoted to detective. Donald Trump appeared earlier at the wake. And all that came days after the mayor visited Rikers Island to be baptized by Reverend Al Sharpton. City Hall later sending out pictures of that ceremony. The mayor also sat down for a rare, longer interview on The Breakfast Club that went viral as he was pressed hard on his alternating rhetoric about how terribly safe and how terribly dangerous New York City is by defense attorney and abolitionist Olayemi Olorun, notably NYPD bosses, with Twitter accounts, then challenged her to show up and debate them at Detective Diller's funeral. That's part of a really aggressive new strategy with the NYPD confronting critics, not just abolitionists, as supposedly anti-cop and worse. I know because there was a round of those attacks aimed at me on Sunday about a column I wrote with two chiefs and a commissioner spending the day on those on Twitter, and one of them then promoting them on media appearances throughout the next day as the official account of the NYPD gave me the maybe libelous, but not particularly catchy nickname of Harry Deceitful Siegel, while calling me and my ivory tower latte friends enemies of public order and declaring, quote, "We are the police, you are a gadfly," and on and on and on. So meantime, I have cops and cop reporters filling up my inbox with complaints and concerns, not about the department really, but about the bosses struggling to run it now, including a number of friends of the mayor operating outside of the formal chain of command. I'm not looking to go tit for tat about any of this. I understand that the NYPD would much rather talk about me than they would about criticisms of their policing approach. But Katie, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what's going on with this comm strategy, if that's the word for it. And as it certainly appears that City Hall is on board with various like press secretaries liking these tweets and things like that, even as the mayor and notably the police commissioner have not joined in this approach to this point.
The mayor has a 28% approval rating. How do you think his comm strategy is going? I mean, this is the bottom line. This is what they're dealing with. You have people who withhold information. They try to limit when we can ask questions, what kind of questions we can ask, where we can ask them. The mayor likes to pit this us versus them when it comes to the media. I think what was happening with the NYPD, I don't know how successful they were in this being a comm strategy. They've said it's a way to just fight back against misinformation. We all make mistakes. John Chell has made mistakes. He misidentified a judge when railing against bail reform. He's made even worse mistakes as a police officer. So I think this is just, they were looking for something to jump on and they found this. And I think it gets them back in the press. It gets them TV hits briefly. If you look at the tweets, again, Twitter isn't real life, but if you look at the responses, it's not very positive. It's not like anyone really is genuinely on their side. You see it with the deputy mayor for moderating press conferences, Fabian Levy. When he tries to go after reporters, it's not successful. So again, I've said this before, they're very afraid. This is an administration who, going by their behavior, their backs are against the wall and they don't know what they're doing really. So again, I think seeing top police brass telling a contributor from the Breakfast Club who had factual information, discussing things with the mayor about her views on policing and her views on Rikers Island, challenging her to come to the funeral for a killed police officer so they could discuss this. I don't know if you talk to a beat cop or a cop working overnights or anyone who's married to a police officer who's afraid of what's going to happen to them and afraid of the worst case scenario. I don't know how they'd feel about that being a response, even if they are incredibly down on the media. What they say is the city council being against the police, media being against the police. I just think there's a vast difference between a bunch of top brass tweeting on Easter Sunday and a police officer actually on the street dealing with people on a day-to-day basis. And there's a pretty wide gulf between that. So I think what we're supposed to do, what are we supposed to do? We're just going to keep doing our jobs. You know, again, like, we write about the mayor. There's ongoing investigations. As I've said before, I didn't seize the mayor's phones. You didn't seize the mayor's phones. The FBI did. So I think a lot of this anger is misdirected.
Well, first of all, it looks like the comms people who were working for the mayor are the same comms people who are working for the British royal family. It is amateur hour over here. I mean, we are one day away from new photos and edits. What I keep seeing when I see, and you know, I told you guys earlier, I've written a lot of tweets and deleted them just because I'm trying to be professional and not be as petty and immature and unprofessional as the people who we pay taxes for. But what I find fascinating is that so many people of color, Black folks, Latinos, so many poor people are constantly saying, the way the police treat us is so disrespectful. They come into our communities and they come in hot. Like, they yell at us, they tell us to get up against the wall. We have no benefit of the doubt. It's like they are the rulers and we are the subjects. And it's like, but we're supposed to be in community. And they keep showing themselves. They keep exposing themselves with every tweet, with every insult to whether it's Harry, to Olu, to whomever dares to criticize them. All they're doing is proving the point of the thousands upon thousands of New Yorkers who've been trying to say over and over again, this is how we're treated in our communities. And to see the top brass behaving in this way, this very Donald Trump, you know, let me just name call until it becomes factual. Let me come up with names for people, as opposed to dealing with the very real questions that have been raised in print and verbally, whether it's on a podcast or on a radio show. And so every accusation is a confession. We've seen this with them and sort of Trumpian folks time and time again. But it's really a nadir. And if I'm the mayor, I want to get my people in check. You don't want it to seem like you've got a police department run amok, because that's the main critique of folks that don't feel comfortable with the NYPD. And so every time they tweet, every time a top brass, someone who puts on this uniform, allegedly to protect and serve all people of New York, and all they're doing is criticizing New Yorkers, where the facts are there, then I just don't understand. I do understand, actually. It clearly has to come from the top, because if the mayor or if the police commissioner said, this is a bridge too far, and you all need to A, get back to work, and B, stop all this nonsense name-calling, because that's not what you're paid for, then it would cease. But clearly, that's not the case, because it's gone on for several days, and they want it to go on for several days. But the problem is, at some point, you're going to have to stop tweeting and start policing and actually answer the questions that we've been asking consistently, which is, why are we paying all this money for extra police, and no one's feeling more safe and secure?
What happened to Detective Diller? It's hard to even think about. This is somebody who was trying to get guns off of the street, his early 30s, young child and a wife, doing that work that I'm really all for. A lot of the people of color you're talking about, Chrissy, if you just look at the polling, these are people who say they want more cops on the trains, often in their neighborhoods. They want to be treated respectfully by those police as two separate things. And Donald Trump was at the wake, and he was behaved and appropriate. And he said, things like this can't happen, and we have to be stronger. And he's Donald Trump. So you can read a lot into that, but none of the words he said were anything other than reasonable, putting aside January 6th and many other things, just those words. So watching the NYPD brass from their official accounts, not the union folks, use this funeral as a sword and a shield and say it's both sacred and political. You know, come, why don't you come there and then debate me? Oh, you didn't show up, is very disconcerting and inappropriate. Plainly, Adams has been fine with this approach. This is his department in pretty much every sense, with all, again, Trumpy, this confusion about who's actually running it and what that means. But I know that no one, Twitter is not real life, that this is a tempest in a little media and NYPD teapot, and that all this will pass. And I don't see it as much more than that. And these guys are welcome to respond to me directly or publicly about columns and those things. But when this descends so rapidly into name calling and from going on TV and talking about how your police are doing the work to saying, and I quote, "We are the police, you are a gadfly," like something is off the rails there. I'll probably have more to say about this in the Daily News on Sunday when this entire media cycle is done and I've had a minute to reflect. But like, I do think there's something really wrong with this group of bosses. That I don't think is a critique of policing or the idea that they don't have some role to play in public safety. And it's just interesting to me in this election year to see how quickly this is becoming apocalyptic and all criticism gets turned into that. I don't think it's healthy.
Right. But Harry, no one was saying that the terrible tragedy death of Officer Diller, no one was saying that that wasn't a bad thing, right? And so for the police brass to conflate this and saying, well, if you critique us, then you obviously like cop killers. No one has said that. No one has ever said that. And I will disagree with you, obviously. I think Donald Trump is actually quite divisive in his remarks, calling people thugs and saying, you know, they don't learn. Who's the they? We have to protect. Who's the we? So like, I hear Donald Trump on a different frequency than I think some white folks. And here we are. So yeah. I actually didn't think that he was well-behaved. You know, he didn't go on a total time.
Oh, no, if you just took his words and gave them to an AI, they were not like, that's the most outrageous thing you've ever heard.
Right.
And of course, they're not just his words and you know who said them and all the rest.
Exactly, because we know the subtext and the context from him, and he speaks in multiple frequencies and dog whistles, dare I say dog barks. But I think it's so genuine of the NYPD to say, so now if you have any critique, then that means you support cop killers. That is what no one has said. No one has said that. No one's even remotely thought that, right? Olu didn't think that. You didn't think that. Anyone who critiques the NYPD online, in print, or just to their faces, no one is saying that. We know this is a hard job. We know that a lot of people have police officers. I have police officers in my family. I can still critique the police as a paramilitary state and how sometimes that thinking of carrying a gun and patrolling a neighborhood gives people a false sense of, you know, manhood and machismo, and that goes for women too, who are police officers. But by no stretch of anyone's imagination are we saying that people who do this incredibly difficult job should be gunned down at their place of work. No one is saying that. And so for them to say, come and debate me at a funeral, that's insulting to the family and inappropriate. For them to say any journalist that dares to critique us, you know, clearly wants to see us dead on the street, that's disingenuous. And we have been asking
They're approaching
these folks,
that. I have to jump in, Chrissy, because they are trying to police very exact fact lines to ignore larger narrative things. And they're suggesting some of this. They're saying it's outrageous that this column criticizing the NYPD's approach underground ran right the day after, they said the day of, Detective Diller's funeral. They made this suggestion that people support these things, but they've limited to the your anti-cop level and left the rest of it implied to this point. And so if I'm giving them the great benefit of the doubt in a way I don't really care to do, and they're certainly not offering to you or to me, I'd say I understand the murder of an officer as like a tribe and building moment and wanting the city to stop and appreciate that and have it above other things. I give them respect that, actually. I just don't think you can simultaneously do that and then wield this killing as a political sword and shield with the daily issues people are dealing with and people who want the police to be doing a professional, decent job providing public safety that is not entirely about arresting people, though that is certainly like one of the significant things police are there to do. And saying anyone who asks for any of that is anti-cop It's just unbalanced.
Yeah, it's cuckoo bananas. Well, and then this is my last point, and this goes to something that Katie's sort of reported on consistently from Room 9 when you're with the New York City mayor, where, you know, you ask a question, he's like, that's off topic, that's old business, we'll get to it later, we'll get to it at the end. What's worried me is now we're starting to see other mayors in other cities adopt this philosophy. And so to see the progressive mayor of Chicago start to talk to his press corps of, oh, well, you know, that's off topic, we'll get to it later on, and then at the end of the press conference just rolls out. This is sort of, I was concerned about this during de Blasio, and I'm definitely concerned about it during Adams. What the New York City mayor does and gets away with, and what the NYPD does and gets away with, whether it's harassing citizens or harassing journalists, it seems like other cities follow suit. Since we're the largest city, smaller cities follow suit. And we cannot have police departments across the country harassing journalists because they dare to sort of present the facts of what is and is not happening in those departments. And we can't have mayors who just, I mean, we saw it with de Blasio, where it's just like, I'm just going to ignore your question, or I'm just going to say that, like, it's essentially, he didn't say fake news, but he might as well have, when people called him out and asked him legitimate. We're seeing Eric Adams kind of double down on that in this very Cuomo Trumpian way. What is in the water in Queens? We see it time and time again, and it's spreading to other cities. And that's actually what makes me quite nervous.
Yeah. I mean, as a reporter, you just kind of navigate around it. But dealing with the mayor's press office is painful. They don't answer questions. You have to yell out questions. You know, I probably come off as incredibly obnoxious, but like, I have a question to ask, and it's Monday, and a lot of stuff happened this weekend, and I'm not going to sit around and wait till Tuesday to wait for someone to maybe not call on me. You know, it's sort of, and I know the mayor has tried to engage other media. That hasn't really been successful either. I mean, I'd love to know who booked him on The Breakfast Club. Liz Kim at Gotham has an interesting story today, speaking with her and how she kind of couldn't even believe the mayor was coming on. But I know the mayor does these things thinking it's sort of, oh, I'm not afraid of a fight. Look, I know there are a lot of takeaways from that Breakfast Club interview, but sort of the way at a certain point, the thing that really summed up the mayor to me was at a certain point, he turned away and pretended Olu wasn't there. And said, oh, she'll see. It's sort of a very disrespectful way. And then I think of seeing the behavior from some of the NYPD top brass, contrasting it with the allegations in a lawsuit filed 2 weeks ago now about the way the NYPD operates, sexual harassment and retaliation when it's been complained about. That to me, it's all telling. And then, of course, you know, I didn't listen when Chell was on, the chief of patrol was on 1010 Wins yesterday. But he said of you, Harry, and this was the thing that got me. He hates the administration. He's anti-cop. We're battling a segment of the people that hates cops. We're not going to sit back and just take it. We're going to push back. To me, he hates the administration, sums everything up. This is clearly coming from the top. This is powerful men with big egos that bruise very easily. And it starts with Mayor Eric Adams. So, you know, we'll see. Today is Tuesday. We'll see what happens at Off Topic Tuesday. We'll see what he answers, what he doesn't answer, and we'll figure out from there.
Hot damn. Stay tuned. And with that, here's Albert Foxconn. Albert, welcome back to the podcast. Seems like all the tech stuff is happening at once. We got to talk for a minute later about self-driving cars and what's happening there. But the big one seems to be AI mobile weapons detectors going around the train station starting in 90 days. Adams modeled this with a device from this company, Evolve, which is closely tied to two people who paid into a pro-Adams PAC. And his boss has been like, the trains are a bad use case. They won't say if this AI detects knives, blah, blah, blah. But there's a lot happening here with the NYPD under Adams and technology. Do you want to fill listeners in on this weapons detection and the general state of play here?
Yeah, rarely in the course of human events has one person said so many bad ideas so loudly in such a short period of time. So, I mean, let's stop calling this an AI weapons detector. This is a metal detector, all right? It is a metal detector. Now, they have all these glossy materials. They have all these brochures. But when you look at the documentation for how this works, they say in their own documents, this does not detect non-ferrous objects. So what does that mean? It detects ferrous metals. And there's already a New York student who is suing this company, Evolve, for allegedly failing to detect a weapon that was brought through it. So taking a step back, horrible series of events on the subways. People were shaken. The headlines were bad for the mayor. He wanted a quick fix, as usual. He turns to tech, as usual. And he's worked with this company, Evolve, before. But when we've seen it piloted, the plane's never taken off. It's really just been one disaster after another. And I think what we will quickly see is if they ever actually deploy these to the subway, it'll be long lines, it'll be lots of complaints, but it won't actually be safety.
So, Albert, thanks for coming back on. Can you just, I'm so frustrated. Can we back up? Who thought this was a good idea? Did they get citizen buy-in? Who's leading the charge? How much is it going to cost us? And are there particular stations that they're focusing on to do this? I mean, it just looks like one of those high school metal detector rollouts.
Yeah, it's the high school metal detector, but so much more expensive. So a traditional metal detector, you can buy for a few thousand bucks. The Evolve system, you're talking about leasing it for $125,000 for 5 years. It's a huge amount of money to get one of these systems. And the whole sales pitch is, oh, these are using AI. But when you look at how it actually operates, it's a tube detector. It looks for metal tubes. And if that metal tube is in a gun barrel, it flags it. But if it's also in a laptop, it flags it. If it's in an umbrella, it flags it. And so what you end up with is something that creates a lot of delays, a lot of lines, and a lot of inconvenience. But who thought this was a good idea? No one knows. There was no public process on this. But maybe Harry knows. It seems like...
I have an answer to that. So there was polling last year. I don't think the question has been asked since, but the other numbers all track with where we're at. Like 85% of New Yorkers say they supported at that point more police officers on the train. 63% said they supported metal detectors, which is how it was asked there, at entrances. So I'm very skeptical of this idea, but one, it does seem like there is some public support, at least in premise for it. And two, as a technology critic, I'm curious what is problematic about this past the prospect of long lines, just given that I think it's fair to say pretty much all New Yorkers would be happy not having guns on the trains.
Well, one of the reasons the CEO of this company thought it was a terrible idea, it was that he said, well, this is a bad operating environment. You don't want these down in the subway system around all of the train equipment. The signal interference is going to degrade the quality of the scan. And I think people want these as long as they work, right? They want these when they actually believe that there is a quick and effective way to know who is armed and who isn't. But what they don't want is to throw a lot of money after something that's either going to require you to, you know, show up 30 minutes in advance for your train like it's a TSA checkpoint, or it's just going to be all for show. And those are the two options, right? Because metal detectors, the more you crank up the sensitivity, the more false positives you get, the more like people like my mom are going to get pulled over just because they have, you know, some groceries with them. And the more you crank down that sensitivity, the more weapons are going to slip through. And there's really no magical solution here. And that's the power of Eric Adams' tech policy. It is the power of magical thinking. You have the press conference. You tell us about all the positive use cases. You tell us about the best case scenario. You ignore the costs. You ignore the errors. And that is the type of policy we've seen from him since the day he got into office.
So with the power of magical thinking, I always think that so many of the Adams policies are performative theater because, as you said, if you crank it up, so does that mean it captures people who have, you know, hip replacements and miscellaneous things? But, I mean, as Harry said, we were unclear as to who the buy-in is. Who are, besides the mayor, who are the electeds that signed off on this, that co-signed it, and what stations are they going to start with?
So the mayor talked about using another debunked piece of technology to figure out where to put this high-tech dumpster fire. So he talked about using data from ShotSpotter. ShotSpotter, I think I've talked about it before. It's an array of directional microphones. They put it primarily in public housing and other disproportionately low-income BIPOC communities. And it's supposed to automatically detect when and where a gunshot is heard. Problem is that when Chicago looked at the data on this, they said 90% of these gunshots you're reporting just aren't accurate. These are gunshots that never happened, and we're sending officers to crime scenes that don't exist looking for people who aren't there. And so now you have the prospect of this junk data from one surveillance tool being used to justify which stations we use to install this whole new set of surveillance tools, which have already been debunked. And this hasn't even gotten into the fact that this company, it's getting investigated by the Federal Trade Commission. It's getting investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's getting sued by its own investors for fraud in a class action case. So this is like a deeply, deeply troubled company. And you know, I think that really, if we had had a meaningful process where the public and other electeds had a say, you would never see this sort of company being rolled out in a rush. But I agree, this is a mayor whose main focus is managing the news cycle. And that's why I think if there aren't bad headlines about transit in the end of the 90-day review period, this may never actually happen.
And Albert, you touched upon this a little bit with mentioning Mayor Adams, but who are some of the other elected officials and at least powerful people who've pushed for some of this? I know TWU has pushed for more safety for its own, you know, because their workers and their members are actually the ones in the subways and on the buses kind of dealing with all this. But if you want to just talk a little bit about that political push.
Yeah, and I think that there's a whole spectrum, right? So there's the broader push for safety enhancements in transit, right? And you do see the transit workers pushing for that. You see a lot of the strap hanger campaigns pushing for this. You see a lot of members of the public who want to feel safer, right? So there's that broader desire for safety, but then there's the actual tactical response, right? And that's where you get into things like the governor pushing bag checks, which again is theatrical because, you know, we all are old enough to remember that the reason bag checks were rolled out post 9/11 was to stop bombs, not to find guns or knives, because guess what, Leo? If someone is carrying an explosive device, they're not going to put it in their pants pocket. And so it made sense to look at for large objects in these bags. But, you know, when it comes to guns and knives, that never made sense at all. And so, again, whether it's the National Guard, whether it's Evolve, whether it's the idea of deploying more cops in certain ways, you see a lot of desire for safety. But I haven't seen any major stakeholders, you know, rushing to applaud the Evolve rollout. I mean, I think a lot of the riders groups are coming out and saying, if this is effective and if it doesn't delay riders, then it could be good. But making it clear that those are very big ifs.
I guess the other question too, the criticism that people have, right? And I had this when the National Guard was coming to the subways. What's, you know, the biggest threat is actual other people, people who need help, people who need intervention because of their mental health, people who even do maybe need more actual police help to say someone's acting inappropriately, someone's not, you know, behaving in a way they should be, they need to be involved. So I joked, what's the National going to do? Confiscate someone's hands, because that is an issue. So I know this just adds another element to that. There's, it's not just all guns and knives, it's actual physical violence.
Yeah, and the awful incident that sparked this, it wasn't a shooting, it wasn't a stabbing, it was a person being pushed. And I think that when you think about the ways to protect people from those scenarios, they're expensive and they take long-term infrastructure. But if we were to actually stop spending so much on just like, you know, scaling up the number of uniforms in the subway system every time we're worried about crime, instead had spent that money up front on like barrier systems in the stations where that's appropriate to, you know, eliminate the risk of being pushed onto the tracks, to me, that's a far more effective safeguard against a lot of the nightmare scenarios. I mean, we've all been in those sketchy moments, those really, really scary moments where you are in a very close and precarious space, yep, with someone you don't want to be close to because they are clearly in crisis or they're clearly, you know, looking to create a confrontation. And in those moments, the thing that I worry about most is being in a narrow space where I can be pushed onto the tracks. You know, in a place like London, that's not a risk because they can't push you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, Albert, what we talk about a lot on the podcast, what I talk about a lot on the podcast is that I would feel like my money was going someplace if I didn't see cops in these clusters by the turnstile. Like, it seems like the conversation is always about fare jumping, which, yep. You know, I teach at Lincoln Center. So I always see blue-haired ladies, they're not jumping the turnstile, but they're walking through the exit, you know, free of charge, and no one says anything, and cops are right there. So I just see them as these, like, camp counselor clusters, but not on the platform where people are getting pushed, not on the subway where we're seeing people in crisis. I mean, yesterday I was on the subway, and a man was smoking full-on weed just on the subway, yep. Rubbish all around him. Like, we all know that scenario. So there's not the patrolling, the good old-fashioned 1950s policing, I guess, where you're sort of having a beat cop actually patrolling an area. In this case, the subway. We don't see that. We don't see them on the platforms. We see them, you know, by the kiosk on their phones. And if I say the word Candy Crush one more time, because that's what I keep seeing, right? Yep. Four cops in a huddle, either talking to their friends on their phones, playing a game, or, you know, just completely not paying attention. Not even paying attention to the fare jumpers, which I have also seen. So my issue is that I feel like we're spending a lot of money on this performance theater, but I don't feel safer on the subways because there aren't any cops on the subways. I don't feel safe on the platforms because there aren't any cops on the platforms. So why do we have this disconnect to what's happening up top with this bag searching, with the camouflage, gun-toting people from the National Reserve, all these cops, adding more cops, adding metal detectors, very expensive ones at that, but we're not seeing a decrease in public safety or feelings of public safety.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of the cops I see on their phones are spending more time playing Subway Surfer than looking for Subway Surfers or other people breaking the rules. I mean, it's just, it is infuriating, right? Because we know that every hour they spend there, given the NYPD salaries, given the overtime, that is like a couple different teacher salaries. That's so many other city employees. And I think that basically we have seen the city, instead of trying to reevaluate the tactics it uses, simply investing in doing more of the same. Not because those tactics have a proven public safety benefit, but because they have a proven public relations benefit. The mayor loves being able to say he's putting more cops out there. He doesn't have to answer questions about, well, what is their utilization rate? What percentage of their shift are they spending doing different types of engagement? What is the average day in the life of an officer in this patrol looking like? None of that data is out there because all he wants is that, you know, 10-second soundbite for the news. And so I think that part of this is on the local TV stations for keeping this narrative alive that simply ratcheting up the number of uniforms means ratcheting up the level of safety. I don't think there are simple answers, but I think that most of this comes down to long-term infrastructure projects. It comes down to the stuff you can't solve in a single news cycle, and that's stuff like long-term supportive housing, long-term supportive wraparound services, having the sort of holistic care that we know can help with stabilizing people in crisis, having the sort of, you know, improvements that help actually create a better, more livable city. But that's not stuff you can do in a single day or a single week. And so we keep taking terrible short-term solutions ahead of the long-term fixes that actually stand a chance.
So that's a whole deep conversation about what you need to do to buy time and to actually get the upstream solutions and to all that. And there are obviously questions here. And with these weapons detectors, with the Candy Crush cops and elsewhere, about what sort of enforcement you do and don't want to offload to cameras and other things. There's all those things online where on train track one, there's two babies tied down, and on train track two, there's nine old people tied down. And which train are you going to put the track on? I don't know how to answer those. But I can't wait for robots to start answering those on their own, which seems to be coming as our closing question here. This technology is coming whether we like it or not, so we're going to make sure we get it right. Eric Adams said, if we do, our streets can be safer and our air could be cleaner. He's talking, of course, about test driving autonomous cars, although self-driving cars, with a human driver sitting there while they're test driving in New York City. Other cities have rolled this out. There does feel like there's inevitability here, and I just love your thoughts on this as somebody thinking about technology and surveillance, because, of course, we also have cop cars all around the city with scanners now and all that, and what's happening with self-driving cars.
Yeah, no, I shameless plug, I do have a chapter in my forthcoming book about this. And, you know, look, when San Francisco rolled this out, it rolled over a city resident. We saw someone who was not only hit by a self-driving car, but trapped under a self-driving car as it backed up and completely exacerbated her injuries. And when this happened, the car company lied about it, hid it from regulators, hid it from the local officials. And, you know, Eric Adams has it completely wrong. We can have self-driving cars in the United States without turning the most congested, most dangerous, most confusing and baffling driving environment known to humanity into the test bed. This isn't the place where you want to do R&D. This isn't the place where you want to tinker and experiment with the self-driving cars when they're still a work in progress. This is the place you want to come when you've actually ironed that stuff out at the last possible phase, when you actually know the technology works. But this is just more of the same from it. Like, we are not going to control when the Department of Transportation enables self-driving cars nationally. We're not going to control when these car companies actually figure out their software. What we can control is if we allow our city to be turned into a giant, you know, testing ground for these massive tech companies. You know, San Francisco regretted this so hard. Their fire department has been fighting this for years, talking about the number of first responders who have been delayed. And having a person in the car is not some magical solution. You know, there have been people killed by these self-driving cars when the person who was supposed to chaperone them was on their phone. Because guess what? The cars are going to operate fine 90% of the time, 95% of the time. And try to imagine being at a job where you literally stare and do nothing for hours at a time, in the off chance that in one moment you have to act in a split second to save a life. I don't care how much, you know, caffeine you have in your system, there's no way you're going to stay awake and alert for that long. And I just think it's another sort of PR solution rather than a real public safety solution.
Albert, it's been a while. Thanks for coming back on, and much more to discuss. We will continue soon. Yes.
Always happy to get on my high tech soapbox.
FAQ.
FAQ NYC is recorded out of the city, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to hard hitting news that serves the people of New York. The pod receives support from P&T Knitwear, an independent bookstore, cafe, and event space on Manhattan's Lower East Side, with a podcast studio that can be freely reserved for community use. We're an affiliate of the Colin Powell School at CUNY City College, where Dr. Christina Greer is one of the Moynihan Public Scholars inaugural fellows, and of Flaming Hydra, a collective of 60 writers, including Harry Siegel, co-delivering a cooperatively owned new newsletter. See more and subscribe at flaminghydra.com. I'm our engineer, Adam Kamara, and Harry Siegel is our executive producer. A special thank you to our guest, Surveillance Technology Oversight Project Executive Director, Albert Fox Kahn. And thank you, listener, for joining us and making it this far. Be kind, be cool, and we'll be back soon with more.